European powers.
Trade between African countries and Russia has seen considerable progress. Speaking during the Russia-Africa summit in 2019, President Putin said Russian companies have been working in Africa for a long time now.
We see diversification of Russian export. Its structure is changing towards non-commodities. Russian companies have been quite successfully working in the region for a long time, mostly dealing with geological service and mineral resources extraction in energy, oil and gas sectors. At the same time, steps are being made to establish cooperation in high tech.
Currently, Russian exports to Africa are worth $14 billion a year, and imports of African products stand at about $5 billion. This represents a doubling in Russian-African trade since 2015, or an average annual growth rate of 15%. African countries stand to gain, especially economically and politically, from improved ties with Russia.
That Russia is open to different forms of ties with Africa. I mean, they've seen that they already have what they would term as humanitarian ties in terms of these research and education programs which African students attend. But I mean, this would be going more into business and the area of forming some kind of financial relationship, which is mutually beneficial.
The United States is in the process of passing a law titled Countering Malign Russian Activities in Africa Act. This law, already passed by the House of Representatives, seeks to punish African states that back certain Russian actions and could have major implications for African countries. This legislation has attracted sharp criticism in Africa.
South African Minister of International Relations Naledi Pandor slammed the legislation as she hosted U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken during his recent visit to the country. Let's take a listen.
But in terms of our interaction with some of our partners in Europe and elsewhere, there has been a sense of a patronizing bullying toward you choose this or else. And the recent legislation passed in the United States of America by the House of Representatives, we found a most unfortunate bill that we'd hoped the media would say more about, because when we believe in freedom, as I'm saying, it's freedom for everybody. You can't say because Africa is doing this, you will then be punished by the United States. So that's been a disappointing passage of legislation by one house, and we hope the other house will not agree to such offensive legislation.
Now, do you think other African countries will also resist this law, which seeks to undermine the independence and sovereignty of countries across the continent?
Well, I think this is an act of desperation from the US. I mean, they've been the bully on the block, uncontested, for at least since the collapse of the Cold War and the Soviet Union. And so they've been able to do what they want, when they want, and there's been no consequences. But if we look at the reaction, for example, of the South African foreign minister, who was beside Blinken at the time, she said, "We don't take orders from you. We act in our own interests." So if anything, and this would be in keeping with other poorly considered coercive US foreign policy lately, that it is more likely to actually accelerate the isolation of the US and the world, because they see it for what it is, a bully that exploits.
Immediately after the Russian foreign minister concluded his African visit, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited three African countries, including South Africa, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Rwanda. US Ambassador to the UN Thomas Greenfield also visited Ghana, Cape Verde, and Uganda after Lavrov's trip to the East African country.
And my last question now, can Washington undo the gains made by Russia in the continent over the recent past?
Well, I mean, we've seen what they've been Africa, like other non-Western countries, is watching what the United States is doing in Europe and in Asia, and they see nothing of benefit for them. In fact, they see risks and threats for them. They might tour, they might get a somewhat cordial welcome, but you can see the difference between how on the African continent Putin and Lavrov were welcomed as opposed to these other ones. I mean, it's a great deal of difference. I mean, you have this stiff, formal facade with the US, but with the Russian delegations, you actually have some human feeling. So this is about human relations. And they understand that the US wants to exploit and keep them down. I mean, this is what they've been doing for decades.
Well, our guest there says that African nations are aware that the U.S. seeks to exploit them and suppress their progress. I would like to thank Greg Simons for his analysis. Now we now take a short break before our next topic on the need for Africa to rethink export diversification. Stay with us.
Africans urged to think export diversification. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development says African countries must diversify their exports to survive economic shocks from global crises such as the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine.
In its Economic Development in Africa Report 2022 published last July, UNCTAD said African countries can diversify their economies through boosting exports of high-level services, expanding private businesses' access to financial services, tapping into new financial technologies, and implementing effective policies.
An African economist at this UN agency says there is a missing link in policies pursued by African countries leading to lack of export diversification.
Most of the diversification strategies have focused mostly on either diversifying away from one sector into another one, or maybe diversifying within the same sector, trying to add new products and services without ensuring that the conducive skills, technology, financing, and other structural factors are in place to kind of foster diversification into more value-added products and services.
Now, to discuss the UN report on the need for Africa to implement export diversification policies, we contacted Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
And thank you so much for having me.
The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development says Africa is among the least diversified regions in the world with regard to exports. Now, commodities account for more than 60% of total merchandise exports in 45 of the 55 countries in Africa, leaving them highly vulnerable to global commodity price shocks. Now, what's your view on this statement by this UN agency?
Africa's economy is dependent on primary commodity trade, and that already faces, of course, fluctuations and it is easy to suffer shocks in terms of trade shocks when such disasters and pandemics do happen. So diversifying into value-added products, but also into higher value chains of products and trade, then makes it more easier for Africa not only to sustain her economy, but also to become competitive at the global value chains at this cost. So it is a very valid and fundamental prescription at a time when African countries are looking at jump-starting their economies post-COVID-19, but also when they have just concluded the continental free trade area that seeks to increase intra-African trade, but also Africa's trade with third parties.
British trade unions opposed to the European Union say a £30 billion a year subsidy regime allows the EU to dump thousands of tons of heavily subsidized food into Africa every year. As a result, local producers cannot export their products because they compete with the lower prices made possible by the EU's common agricultural policy. African and European farmers have been holding protests outside EU offices calling for an end to dumping by the EU. At this demonstration, an African activist explains how unfair EU subsidies are hurting African dairy farmers and forcing young people to migrate to Europe.
It's important because we have more than 40 million of people in West Africa who are living from milk production and livestock. So when you destroy their livelihood, they have no choice to migrate in Europe or abroad.
Have colonial and imperialist powers contributed to the stifling of industrial growth and value addition chain in Africa so that their own industries continue to thrive at the expense of Africa's industrial development?
The factories, the industry sector of Europe, be it from energy, be it from markets, be it from value addition, it is heavily reliant on Africa for the raw materials. So take raw materials out of the equation and the industrial sector in Europe, the manufacturing sector in EU would collapse. And that is why the EU, through agreements like the Economic Partnership Agreement, has been fighting so hard to ensure that we have, that the EU gets unhindered access to raw materials, but also unfair liberal trade regimes where cheap products from the EU will find their way in Africa and threatening.
The African Continental Free Trade Area aims to create a single market for the continent's 1.4 billion people. Speaking last year during the opening of Secretarial for the Continental Trade Body in Accra, Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo reiterated his country's preparedness to lead in the implementation of the African Continental Free Trade Area Initiative.
In Ghana, believe that an increase in trade is the surest way to deepen regional integration in Africa. It will mean a rapid increase in the exchange of agricultural, industrial, financial, scientific, and technological products, which would significantly enhance our economic fortunes as a continent, create prosperity, and provide opportunities for employment for the broad masses of Africans, particularly the youth.
UNCTAD says high knowledge-intensive services such as information technology and financial services could be a game-changer for Africa, but they account for only 20% of the continent's service exports, leaving immense room for growth. Now, how can this sector be boosted in Africa?
Yeah, of course, that is happening. Currently, Africa is experiencing what development commentators call premature deindustrialization. Now, premature deindustrialization is where you find that the services sector, ICT and all that, is growing more and at a higher level than the manufacturing sector. Usually, it is the manufacturing sector which should grow and then provide a base for other sectors like the services sector to start growing. Unfortunately, we are seeing differently, and that's why we are having premature industrialization now. In order to ensure that we look at that the public, the ICT sector and the technology aspects contribute to development. It is important that we leverage on agriculture. We bring back connecting ICTs into the productive sector like agriculture, agroindustrialization, because our economies as Africa are built on the agriculture sector.
The African Union Summit on Industrialization and Economic Diversification will be held in November. Now touted as a highly anticipated timely gathering, the summit is expected to unlock the continent's potential to industrialize. Now, are you hopeful that this summit will bring the desired changes?
No, it won't. Because later we need to, I am sorry for sounding pessimistic, because all the flags, the red flags already point to that, to my pessimism. Because when you look at the requirements for Africa's industrialization and structural transformation, issues of technology transfer, issues of mineral beneficiation, to date, 97% of the mining agreements and contracts in Africa are owned by foreign entities, non-African. Value addition to date in the majority of African countries, value addition in the extractive sector takes place out of Africa. And there has been a lot of challenges when it comes to industrialization, when it comes to agro-processing, when it comes to infrastructure that is responsive for industrialization, when it comes to technology transfer.
Now there you have it. Imperialist powers are not keen on seeing Africa attaining rapid industrialization. So it is incumbent on African countries to liberate themselves from dependency on parasitic Western countries. I would like to thank our guest, Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist, for his incisive analysis today. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
The fact that global commodity giants are making record profits at a time when hunger is rising is clearly unjust and is a terrible indictment of world food systems. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading Disaster Capitalism at its Worst. Profits of grain giants spark global criticism. Here's the details. Oligopoly in action. That's how Katrick Raj, a Human Rights Watch researcher focused on poverty and inequality in Western Europe, responded recently to The Guardian's new reporting on the roles for grain giants raking in record profits, which is fueling calls for a global windfall tax. After noting United Nations agencies' estimates that while about 345 million people endure acute food insecurity, up over 200 million from before the COVID-19 pandemic, food prices have skyrocketed by over 20%. Journalist Fiona Harvey highlighted remarks from Oliver D. Stutter, a co-chair of International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems, and UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. The fact that global commodity giants are making record profits at a time when hunger is rising is clearly unjust and is a terrible indictment of world food systems, he told Harvey, adding, what's even worse, these companies could have done more to prevent the hunger crisis in the first place. As Harvey explained, four companies, the Daniels Midland Company, Bung, Cagril, Louis Dreyfus, known collectively as ABCD, control an estimated 70-90% of the global grain trade. Global grain markets are even more concentrated than energy markets and even less transparent, so there is a huge risk of profiteering, said D. Stutter. He said this year's food price surge happened despite what are thought to be abundant global grain reserves, but there was insufficient transparency from the companies to show how much grain they hold and no way to force them to release stocks in a timely way. We need to be looking at the grain giants and asking what they could have done to avert the crisis and what they could be doing now, D. Stutter said. While the four companies declined to respond to Harvey's request for comment, the Stutter added that ultimately we need to break up the monopolies that have a stranglehold on the food chain. A handful of companies control global seed and fertilizer markets, animal genetics, the global grain trade, and food retail. They are making huge profits at the cost of farmers, consumers, and the environment. Using a term coined by author Naomi Klein, UK climate scientist Bill Maguire declared in response to Harvey's article, Disaster Capitalism at its Worst. As 345 million people suffer from acute food insecurity, Maguire continued, the four corporations that control virtually all grain trade stuff their pockets with cash and laugh all the way to the bank. Nick Dearden, director of the UK-based group Global Justice Now, similarly said that food monopolies rake in bumper profits as speculation drives up food prices. We have enough food for everyone, but the financial markets dictate more and more people must go hungry to fill the coffers of the super wealthy. Workers' wages aren't causing cost of living crisis. Profiteering is. Want proof? UNI Global Union tweeted pointing to Harvey's reporting, which details some of what's fueling the current issues. The UK group Plan B is to aim at government leaders, bonanza for fossil fuel companies, while people can't pay their bills, soaring stocks for defense companies on the back of the war. And while famine stalks East Africa and Afghanistan, food companies make record profits. None of us voted for this, they said. As Common Dreams reported in June, Oxfam has spent the summer pushing for a windfall tax targeting major companies. Harvey noted recently that some campaigners and political figures have echoed that demand, including Natalie Bennett, a UK Green Party peer, who said that, as a short-term measure, there are strong arguments for a windfall tax on the food oligopoly. The handful of companies with significant cross-ownership from hedge funds that from seeds to supermarkets are major contributors to the inflation that's driving the cost of living crisis to new highs.
If you agree with me that travel is most rewarding when it surprises, then Iran might just be the most rewarding destination on Earth. By having lush, dense forests in the north, warm, sunny beaches in the south by the Persian Gulf, snowy mountains in the west, and amazingly hot deserts in the east, Iran is one of the few countries that gives the joy of experiencing four different seasons at the same time to travelers. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. With an area of 1.6 million square kilometers, Iran is the 18th largest country in the world and the second largest in the Middle East. Its area roughly equals the area of France, Spain, and Germany together. Iran's diverse and striking landscapes offer a wealth of breathtaking and spectacular views to discover. This week on Aperture's Iran Trotter series, Jawad Gharayi will go to Bahu Kalat in the south of Iran, where the turquoise waters meet the hot sand of the desert. Here's the first part.
The living world is filled with unparalleled beauties. Beauties represented by Mother Nature across this beautiful planet. A planet that's been the only habitat for humans since they came into being millions of years ago. The beauties of nature have forever captivated humans everywhere. Many of what humans have created over millennia were inspired by their natural environment. To many humans, the word nature conjures up images of mountains and forests, but nature has thousands of other beautiful facets, and some of those facets manifest themselves in sharp contrast to each other. One of the most beautiful faces of Mother Nature is the barren areas of land, or deserts. Many nature explorers believe that deserts and steppes are the most beautiful parts of nature, and the most beautiful parts of these parts are the sand dunes and hills. But is there anywhere in the world with expanses of shifting dry sand dunes right next to a great body of salt water named the sea? Hi, I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm taking you on a journey to the most pristine areas of this beautiful land. Chile is a beautiful country with unique natural exquisiteness. A country that remarkably has vast steppes and shifting sand dunes along the coast of the Pacific Ocean, offering a natural scene of unparalleled beauty. Of course, I haven't traveled to Chile's beautiful Pacific coast. My destination is the Bahu Kalat rural district in the south of Iran's Sistan and Baluchistan province. But I'm not going straight to Bahu Kalat. I begin my trip near the border between Hormozgan and Sistan and Baluchistan provinces. There are few places in the world where sand dunes meet the sea, creating a spectacular landscape. Such coastal deserts can only be seen in parts of Chile, in the Great African Sahara, and in the Southwest African country of Namibia. Some may find it hard to believe, but in addition to those few places in the world, there is an area in southern Iran where expansive sand fields meet the Sea of Oman. A place near the village of Darak in Zaravan County. The border between Sistan and Baluchistan and Hormozgan provinces, in the southernmost area of Baluchistan on the coast of the Sea of Oman. In the past, this area of Iran was called Mukran, a name researchers say was derived from the word muk, meaning the palm tree. Given its large number of palm groves, Baluchistan can be referred to as the land of palm groves in Iran, an area with a beautiful history and peerless natural splendor. Unfortunately, the general public in Iran doesn't know much about Baluchistan. The sea, the sand dunes, and the Martian mountains, all in one place, provide an environment with no parallel in Iran and, I dare say, in the world. But the sand dunes, the Martian mountains, and the Sea of Oman aren't the only things that make this area of Baluchistan unique. It's the multitudes of palm and other trees scattered along this area, as well as the many herds of camels, goats, and sheep grazing among these dunes and mountains that make for breathtaking beauty. Here, Mother Nature has made all her efforts to create some of the most beautiful coastal sceneries in the world, and she's done a great job. This is the result of millions of years of work for Mother Nature. So it's incumbent upon us and the authorities to keep these unmatched beauties just as they are, by not allowing any structures, however small, to be built here or in the surrounding area. Not even a few gazebos for tourists and explorers to use. We have to preserve this natural magnificence as it is. A geopark is a unified area that advances the protection and use of geological heritage in a sustainable way and promotes the economic well-being of the people who live in it. Geoparks are protected areas. Many countries dream of having one in its smallest and simplest shape and form. There are only a few geoparks around the world that are both geomorphologically rich and boast unique wildlife, history, culture, and indigenous populations. Countries with such wealth are few and far between. But this area of Baluchistan is home to several morphological splendors. It's also inhabited by Baluch tribes of a rich culture, their traditional lifestyle and time-honored customs, a pure, unspoiled natural environment, the preserved remains from the remote past, the golden sandy coastlines, and the deep turquoise blue waters of the Sea of Oman. The traditional fishing apparatus on boats moored at a beautiful port, and finally, very good vegetation and animal life. As I walk on beautiful sand hills, I think to myself, how are we responsible to the generations that will come into being in this country, to the natural beauties in our country? I'm spending today relishing the stunning untapped natural beauties in Zaravan and snapped several beautiful pictures. The nagging question is, do we have the right to deny the children of tomorrow the opportunity to feast their eyes on such spectacular scenery? I wish no structure, no roads, nothing would be built among these ancient mountains, sand dunes, and palm groves. No hotels, no themed amusement parks to be built for human recreation on its untouched coastline. Even a few simple gazebos in the area can accelerate the destruction of this region's ecology and natural landscape. I wish all of us humans had more appreciation for the natural world, this manifestation of God Almighty's beauty, and paid it due respect. I wish all nature-loving tourists would choose to walk into the heart of nature, and by doing so prevented any harm to it. A lot of people in the world think that if they really want to enjoy their expedition into nature, they have to spend the night in multi-star hotels near their destinations. But that's not the right mentality. It's not in anyone's interests. Hotels that are built close to natural habitats do nothing but damage an intricate ecology that's taken millennia to be formed. There's an alternative way for explorers to both enjoy their trips into the heart of nature and for the natural world to be spared damage by humans. In other words, for humans to forge a partnership with the natural world. Local homes, campfires and black tents, and also camping tents are the best options. All the people and officials in this area of Balochistan say they hope that in the near future, the area they live in will be registered as an important and valuable geopark by the relevant authorities living in the capital city. And by doing so, they hope the unique natural environment here and the culture and customs of the old Baloch tribes inhabiting this region will be preserved and protected. I take great pleasure walking about in this beautiful natural landscape and accompanying camel herders, but this is the end of this leg of my journey. I have to set off for my main destination, the Bahu Kalat district in the north of Balochistan. The main purpose of this trip is to visit an idyllic little village by the name of Shir Gawaz, a lush, vast, green patch of land 30 kilometers to the border with Pakistan. The name Shir Gawaz was derived from the names of two wild animals, namely the lion and the boar. The locals here tell me this area is home to wild boars, but no one has ever sighted any trace of lions here or anywhere in Iran, unless in the very distant past. Perhaps what ancient Shir Gawaz inhabitants meant by the word lion was in fact the wolf or hyena. That's because those two species have lived in this region for hundreds of years. But what has brought me to this area of Balochistan wasn't the lion or the boar. I've come here to see the Asian crocodile. Parlance, the rare species of crocodile is called the Gondo. They live somewhere between River Sarbaz, Bahu Kalat, and Shir Gawaz. The river is the biggest natural stream of water in Balochistan. It is known by different names by the locals living in villages located along its 300-kilometer course, monikers such as Sarbaz, Bahu Kalat, and Shir Gawaz. My team and I have to walk a long distance to see one of those short-nosed crocodiles. But these gorgeous, thick-skinned aquatic reptiles in Iran are said to be very shy animals, making it difficult for us to find one. What that means is you can't get too close to these amphibians and admire their beauty at close range. We have been going about gunning for a crocodile for a couple of hours now, but we haven't been able to see even one just yet. As I say, they are very shy animals. The locals tell me I'd be lucky to see one, though they also say if you wait long enough, you'll definitely be able to see at least one. Guy is around 3 meters long. The people in this area call them the Gondo. Who would have thought that you could see Gondos, the short-nosed Asian crocodiles, in a river in Iran's Sistan and Balochistan province? At their biggest, these majestic reptiles are 3.5 meters long. The primary habitats of the short-nosed Asian crocodile are in Iran, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Myanmar. The people of Shirgwaz tell me the best place to see the gondos is the Shirgwaz Dam, a barrier built across the Shirgwaz River to impound its water. The number of crocodiles living in Iran has been estimated at between 300 and 400. The good news is the people of Sistan and Balochistan do not do anything to endanger the survival of these adorable reptiles. The bond between them is unshakable. In general, the Baloch are kind, nature-loving human beings, traits that are rooted in these noble people's culture and creed. The love of nature and of animals is part of the life and culture of the Baloch people. Animals are part of the family, among them wild animals. Probably if this were another city or country, many people would try and, man, this guy is strong. I bet if I let him go, he's definitely gonna break my bones or break my camera into pieces. As I was saying, if this mountain goat were anywhere other than here, without a doubt some heartless poacher would have gunned it down by now. But the people here love animals dearly. The gondos that we saw earlier, they're conserving them so well. Also this wild goat, that's very close to the hearts of the people here. You can see many peacocks, partridges and pheasants in the households here in Shirgwaz, and also in other villages elsewhere in Balochistan. The Shirgwaz River flows past Bahu Kalat village, providing the hard-working community here with water for their farms, fruit groves, and animals. Perhaps there are many people in Iran who are unaware that the fruits grown in Balochistan can only be farmed in tropical climates. But that's exactly what's happening in this province. All of the Iranian banana produce comes from this region. Bahu Kalat is also among the important producers of watermelons in Iran. The cold season is when the watermelons grown here are harvested and distributed across the country. I've just stepped into a fruit grove in Bahu Kalat. In my opinion, this is a veritable piece of heaven. Here, you can see several different species of fruits right next to each other. Something you may not be able to see anywhere else in Iran. Fruits such as bananas, dates, mangoes, papaya, all kinds of citrus fruits. I've also been told that even coffee is farmed in some of the gardens here. It's just wonderful. I mean, you could go so far as calling this place Little India, located in southwestern Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseinia on July 27, 2022.
The IRIP and our officials need to inform people that the Friday prayer is not merely a congregational prayer in a mosque. Rather, it is a great and important phenomenon in a city, some of its features which I will now state. I will first state these, then I will talk a bit about the gap that exists between the Friday prayers that exist today and how the Friday prayers should really be. Does a gap even exist or not? Naturally, there is one. What matters is how we can close this gap. Well, thankfully there are close to 1,000 or 900 in some Friday prayer leaders across the country. And this is a truly significant number in both big and small cities. They should really do something. If our Friday prayers, the way they are today, are the way that the Friday prayers have been defined to be and held in the way that is expected of them, then the situation should be a bit better than this. That is, there should be some differences. Therefore, this is one of the issues which I will discuss during my talk so that we can try to close this gap.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, who should be the one making this effort? A part of this effort that needs to be undertaken is the responsibility of the Friday prayer leader himself. The Friday prayer leader should make this effort. Another part of it is the responsibility of the respected officials who are present in the center for policy making and collective management of the Friday prayer leaders in Tehran and in other centers. As for the position that the Friday prayers hold, let me tell you in one word that the Friday prayer is a totally unique religious duty and there is nothing like it. When we look into the depths of the phenomenon of the Friday prayer, we see that it is even more unique than Hajj, which is a great multifaceted event. I will discuss some examples of these features now. If you think about this, you will find even more features, especially now that you're faced with this obligation yourselves. One feature is that the Friday prayer connects and ties together two essential factors that are part of a pure life. What are these two factors? One is the remembrance of God, dhikr. The other is the presence of the people.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years.
Guide me from all the ways that
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Last year, when U.S. military forces were withdrawing from Afghanistan, thousands of foreign and Afghan citizens were also trying to get out of the country. In those days, thousands of people gathered outside the airport in the hope that they can go inside and catch a flight out. But American and NATO forces failed to control the situation, and then came a disaster. This side of the canal is where U.S. soldiers were standing, using the barbed wire not to let people pass. And this canal is where people were trying to pass and get over the ridge. The explosion also killed plus 183 persons.
I saw people, including women and children, who were running. There were people carrying the wounded with wheelbarrow. Many of the dead and wounded people were thrown into the canal. Women were running and screaming, trying to get to the hospital. We were so close, so we went there and did what we could do to help them.
It was around 6 p.m. when a suicide bomber entered a crowd of disturbed people and detonated his vest just outside the international airport of Kabul on August 26th last year. At least 183 people were killed, including 170 Afghan civilians and 13 members of the United States Army. Some say all that blood is on the hands of the Americans.
In my opinion, Americans are solely responsible for that disaster. The chaos around the airport was deliberately created by the Americans as a cover to allow them to escape. On the other hand, they were aware that such incidents are probable. So why didn't they stop the evacuation process? Why didn't they disperse the people?
Also, some citizens blame gunfire by U.S. troops after the explosion for at least some of the deaths.
We can't confirm that.
And, the Pentagon in a conference acknowledged that possibly U.S. was responsible for some deaths, but later on they said that ball bearings in the explosive vest created holes in bodies resembling bullet holes. Although this explanation sounds so fishy, it is still not known if gunfire caused some deaths or not. Just hours before the attack, U.S. diplomats in Kabul warned citizens to stay away from the city's airport. They were aware of what was about to come, but were not willing to take any steps towards preventing it. Abdullah Amirzad of Kabul.
Thousands of people rallied in the Gaza Strip to celebrate the Islamic Jihad's victory against the Israeli regime and assert the unity among Palestinian resistance groups. Earlier this month, Israeli forces assassinated a top Islamic Jihad military commander in Gaza, prompting retaliatory attacks by Palestinian resistance movements. Israeli forces killed 49 Palestinians, including 17 children, during the 3 days of fighting. The Islamic Jihad maintains that it has achieved an honorable victory in the latest confrontation with the Israeli regime. Addressing the rally through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Ziad al-Nakhala praised the unity among all Palestinian resistance groups during the three-day war.